Echoes of War is a project documenting local veterans, their families, and survivors of war, and their experience of coming home. Participants gathered for 4 nights in October 2015 at the Arcata Playhouse in a live theatrical event to share their life stories with local audiences. Echoes of War is an original production from Four on the Floor Theater and the Arcata Playhouse. It is partially funded by the California Humanities Community Stories Project. To view companion images to this broadcast, please visit our website, echoesofwar.org. That's echoesofwar.org.
Once I was young, but now I am old. And in all that time, I have not known people who were pro-war. Eisenhower said nobody hates war as much as a combat veteran. That is a truth. But I am one of those people who would not hesitate to take up arms again were the weak and the vulnerable around me threatened by evil. I speak for myself, but it is the warrior's place to stand in a breach for anybody who is threatened. I was 19 years old and a sophomore at the University of Santa Clara. It was the fall of 1966, and I got a letter from the President of the United States saying, "We need you badly." Well, it certainly wasn't goodly. So I showed up. I arrived in Vietnam in September of 1967 and somehow lived through the Holocaust, which is now known as Tet of 68. I served briefly in a headquarters battery, 2 field units, and made it to 3 hospitals. And I came home. "How do you want this?" I asked about this project. And the usual came the reply, "A beginning, a middle, and an end." "A beginning? Okay," I thought. "A middle? Sure. But no end. No coming home." There is no coming home from Vietnam. We left home and family and friends and loved ones, and we went off to fight the enemy like President Johnson asked of us, like our grandfathers did in World War I, our fathers in World War II, our uncles in Korea. Heroes all. We went. We were dutiful. We were faithful. We were loyal. We were courageous. But stranger than fiction, while we were gone, our home left town too. Our friends threw in with the commies. Celebrities visited the commie capital, posed on anti-aircraft guns, and went on making movies more popular than ever. Our media wrung its venal hands with glee as they reported falsely that we were losing this war. Coming home? Where was home? We who loyally went to fight had become the enemies of the very people who sent us. It was a betrayal the likes of which the world had never seen before. Judas would have blushed. Shortly after lifting off from Bien Hoa on my way back to the States, I fell asleep on the 707, only to be awakened a short time later by a stewardess. I was screaming, fighting in my sleep. I was making the other men nervous. Nightmares of jammed rifles and of letting my men down. Those nightmares lasted for years. For years, I woke my beautiful wife to my screams, and worse. Our second daughter, another beautiful little girl, was a sleepwalker, and she would pat quietly into our bedroom, sound asleep, and stand next to me in bed. Like a flash, I'd be on my feet with my hands around her throat, terrifying her, both of us dissolving into tears. A few days after I was stateside, I called home from the Bay Area to let my folks know I was back in country. They told me my childhood buddy John had been killed. I had just seen him on Highway 4 under a bridge. "I hate this war," he repeated. "I hate this war. I hate this war over and over. I want to go home." He was in a mortar platoon in the 9th Division, and now he was dead. I hurried home to his funeral. An angry buzz was in the air. The protesters had no compassion, no shame. I joined John's brother Carl and our buddy Gary, both just home from the war. We put on our uniforms and acted as honor guard at John's funeral. And we put the word out that we'd be at the Yankee Lady, a local beer bar, if anybody would like to discuss the war later that night. Nobody showed, fortunately. But we were trouble. And shortly thereafter, Gary got into a scrape. He was done with people insulting him about his service. That was everywhere. The sheriff called us into his office and told us to get out of town for a few months. Go away. Cool off, he said. So we bought a TR4 with our separation money, and we drove to Mexico, all the way to Mexico City. We were no longer welcome among those whom we had served. It was not long after I went back to university that I was invited to speak at a town meeting. I took the chance. Surely the community would like to know that we were being misused and abused. I told them how the press was lying, that we weren't murderous monsters, that we were under strength because of politics and politicians, that we were being set up to die needlessly, to kill needlessly. The whole war was a sham, had been turned into that by some strange alliance between our press, our government, our friends, and our enemy. There were stories about master sergeants getting caught selling supplies on the black market, supplies that didn't reach us. And our president wouldn't let us win, wouldn't let us finish it. So I told him just that at the meeting. And then the local radio station denounced me as a communist who was trying to warp the minds of the local kids. And I fled town one more time. The American Legion and the VFW refused us admission to their ranks. Our parents were being taught to be ashamed of us. So you betray us, and then you wonder why so many of us ended up addicted to drugs and alcohol and living in the gutter. Those of us that held it together didn't expose our positions. We just watched carefully for your social booby traps. While I was at school, before I met Deborah, my wife, I had a strange and powerful experience. I had fallen asleep in my apartment room, and I had a dream, or was it a presence, that demanded an answer from me. Will you live as a creator or a destroyer? Will you build or will you ravage? I could not wake up. I was in a semi-conscious state, in between worlds, as it were. Now, I knew I had to find human contact, and to this day, I don't know how I managed it, but I got to my feet and over to a friend's house. I walked in. I sat on the couch. I couldn't speak. I couldn't reach out. I couldn't wake up. I sat there in silence, on the edge of a psychotic break for at least another 2 hours. Nobody said a word to me. Until finally, my presence returned to me. But I had the answer to my question. I was a creator. I was not a destroyer. We are made to create, you and I. But we pick each other to pieces day in and day out, and then we put each other back together in some sort of collage of random parts. We look like something that Picasso may have painted in his later period, and we call that normal. And we think we're clever. This is a room of broken people. I invite you to listen carefully to what you're going to be told. The heroes that tell their stories. But look for the subtext and look for the theme. It's all there. All of us have had lifetimes of being broken into small and biting pieces by each other. And we reconstruct each other with our opinions and our worldviews made from the lies of history. But this I have learned. There is only one healing agent in this world, and that is love. I promise you, this nation has not been the same since that time. How do you have a relationship with someone who betrays you? Nope, I'm not home. It took me more than 40 years to touch an American flag. There is no home there. So I beg you, please, don't speak to me of governments and movements and libertinism and politics and politicians. People only do I care about. One Picasso-esque misrepresentation of who we are meant to be at a time. Perhaps, just perhaps, I had to walk this valley in order to say this to you today. We are not something. You are not something. We are somebody, and we're going somewhere, and do not despair. God is in our pain. Faith is the beginning, and love is the end. Thank you.
My name is Chegg Lowry, and I'm here to talk about the original Patriots. I am of Yurok, Maidu, and Achumawi ancestry. These are all native cultures from Northern California. I am related to generations of Native veterans who served in the United States military. I am the great-great-nephew, grandson, great-nephew, nephew, and cousin to many, many veterans. It has been my honor to help Native veterans share their stories about what they did and saw and felt in the service through my writing. As a Native person, I was fortunate to be raised knowing my cultures and our history. Because of this knowledge, I can remember being very conflicted during Veterans Day and Memorial Day events that happened in the town of Susanville, where I was born and raised. I can remember seeing my grandfather, who was a veteran of the 99th Infantry Division, who was given a battlefield commission during the Battle of the Bulge, as he carried the American flag down the middle of Main Street. And I saw many citizens clapping for him. Our Native people today are survivors of an American campaign of genocide and invasion. Why would my grandfather and why would my family members carry that flag? And why would so many of them serve in the United States military? Those questions are what compelled me to reach out to so many Native veterans. I am now writing about Yurok soldiers who served in World War I. The Native men who served in the war to end all wars did not technically have to, as they were not United States citizens. Native people were not given U.S. citizenship until 1924. The year 2017 will mark the 100-year anniversary of America as they joined the Allies in that conflict in World War I. My graphic novel will be finished by then. It will focus on these Yurok men and how they were able to return home. What role did our ceremonies have in their return? How were these men able to get back to their spiritual, emotional, and social centers? They were the first generation of our people in thousands of years to encounter European conflict and war. I hope to honor their journey through my next novel, and I thank you for helping me share today.
My dad is an example of what life will throw at you, and while it changes you, it does not define you. At 19, drafted along with the other poor farm boys, Native Americans, and a few black kids from a tiny town in the middle of Nebraska by a good old boys committee, he was never a part of the national draft lottery. He was okay with going into the Army. His country needed him. He wanted to be of service, to do the right thing, and yeah, see the world. While deployed in Germany, shortly after receiving the news that my grandfather had passed away suddenly from a heart attack, he received his orders that he was being sent to Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division. Over 40 years later, he remembers that experience week by week, the sounds, the smells, the exact village he was in. He returned home to find his family's farm had been sold, along with his tools and most of his belongings. Yet one of his sayings is, "Don't tell me you can't. You can do anything." At 19, I went to college. That was my version of hard. I'm Pauline Kate Russell, and my veteran story begins with Memorial Day, when I saw my father sitting in a lawn chair with his hand shading his eyes all afternoon. He was always the guy who was up at dawn and worked until well after dark, but not on that Memorial Day. Because I spent most of the year across the state with my mom, I decided to call him each and every Veterans Day since I was 11. The only times I've ever seen my father shaken or phased was when he was the initial first responder on a car accident that involved my sister, or when something reminded him of the war. The movie Forrest Gump, returning home from a wildland fire or a shooting as a volunteer firefighter. He rarely talked about the war or his time in the Army. It would only be little things, like the kinds of helicopters they had, the haircuts, a bag of oranges. I always wanted to know more, but it seemed mean to ask. 2 years ago, I was asked if I would like to volunteer as the director of logistics for a local veterans project, North Coast Honor Flight. I thought of my dad and immediately said yes, welcoming the opportunity to give something back to those who have served. I was responsible for the carpool rides, welcome packets, boarding passes, hotel accommodations, and countless other details for 120 people to bring 53 World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam War veterans to our nation's capital to visit their memorials. They received standing ovations at the airports, were welcomed to Washington, D.C. by active duty Marines, by children coming up to them to say, "Thank you for your service," and to shake their hands. We took them through Washington, D.C. with a police escort that forcefully stopped traffic and gave our veterans the respect they deserve. From my over 170 boarding passes, 3 hours of sleep a night if I was lucky, frantically searching for a 90-year-old survivor of the first onslaught at Iwo Jima in the heat of the day at the World War II Memorial, to waiting on the curb at the airport before dawn with 35 wheelchairs, I felt my father's strength with me. I had called him on his birthday before my first honor flight. He had just been to the VA to start filling out his Social Security papers. This was the first time he told me about Vietnam. I was 28. Sitting in the car on the phone for over 3 hours, I now felt that I knew more of this man that I had loved and admired my entire life. He has always given our family a place to call home. The war, whichever one you think of in this past century, may be a distant event for most of us, but for my father and veterans like him, it's right there, always. I'm here tonight as the proud daughter of a Vietnam combat veteran, granddaughter of a World War II British Royal Air Force officer, and a World War II wireless operator who was fluent in Morse code, and the great-great-grandniece of a World War I commander killed in action in the trenches of northern France. I'm here to say thank you to all those who have served.
My name is Ronnie Dalton. I grew up in Fortuna and was Ronnie Loudon then. I'm here to talk about my son, Jamie, and how his story ties into some of the tattoo images you see in this building. Jamie was raised in Mill Valley and was always a little character. Even his nursery school teacher told me that he marched to the tune of a different drummer. When he was in middle school, he said he'd like to get a tattoo. I said, fine, Jamie, as long as it says, I love you, Mom. He did end up getting one right after high school graduation. R.I.P. Ryan, for a close friend who was killed in a car crash. A few months later, he enlisted in the Army Infantry. His first deployment was to Kosovo, where he was part of the NATO peacekeeping force. When he came home a while later at Christmas time, he rolled up his sleeve and said, hey, Ma, I got your Christmas present. So, Sacred Heart, Mother, and Our Lady of Guadalupe taking up the whole top part of his arm. In 2003, he was sent to Iraq as a gunner on a Bradley as part of the 3rd Infantry Division's initial push toward Baghdad. Through his eyes, I saw burned bodies, towns on fire, and civilians used as human shields. We had a get-together for him when he came home. He was pretty upbeat about the whole experience, actually. He loved adventure. He also loved old country music, Budweiser, Marlboros, and Copenhagen. His second deployment in 2005 was different. He was a dismount on a Humvee just south of Tikrit. He spoke of not trusting the Iraqi police and also about the military spins making things sound better than they actually were. His new well-liked company commander, Cahill, was killed on patrol when his Humvee hit an IED. Jamie was one of the first ones there, and he called me a few days later. I asked him about it, and he said, I'm over it now. Nick Booten, who was like a little brother to him, was hit by a grenade. He lost his left eye, had a severe traumatic brain injury, and almost died of a stroke a while later. On his last patrol, they engaged two men from Yemen with a truckload of explosives headed toward Baghdad. He killed the one as he was reaching for a grenade, and I can still hear the harshness in his voice as he talked of yelling and taunting those dead bodies on the side of the highway. He came home soon afterwards. He had new tattoos and two more memorial bracelets. He said he could have had them up his whole arm. We sat around the kitchen table and talked about many things. I told him how bad I felt during our phone calls, just telling him about meeting friends for coffee, going to class, walks, whatever, when he was experiencing the horrific events. He looked at me and said, Ma, all I wanted to hear was normal. I also asked him about PTSD, not because I necessarily thought he had it, but just, as I said, what he'd gone through. He said he might have a little combat stress because when he was drinking, he could either get really angry or even kind of teary, and he thought that was kind of funny, the last one, and he said he'd have to pay attention to that. I told him I always held him in my heart, and he said he knew that. 2 months later, on April 14th, 2006, Jamie's dad called me, said he had some bad news about James. Honestly, I thought maybe he'd been arrested, but his days of getting into bar fights were long over. He was 27, and that wasn't really something he did anymore. No, he'd shot and killed himself at Fort Benning after a night out drinking with his friends. The following week, his little sister Katie and I flew there for the memorial. A lot of his friends were there waiting for us in the airport, and we all were just saying we couldn't believe that this happened. And I'll never forget their eyes. They had these old, deadened eyes in their young, boyish faces. And I also remember that their tattoos covering their arms and legs. For the next 2 days, they never left us. They talked about how smart and funny Jamie was, how he was that guy that they'd always go to if they had a question. Just a few months ago, someone made a comment on Facebook that until they saw me back there, they didn't really think he had a mother. They thought of him as part cyborg, part Stephen Hawking, and part South Park character. After that memorial, we all went to Tattoo Tommy's, where a fellow named Donnie, who did a lot of Jamie's tattoos, put a heart with Jamie's name on it right above mine. 2 years later, I moved there to Columbus, Georgia, where Fort Benning is located. I needed to do something with soldiers that related to what they'd experienced, And I also just needed to be in that place where Jamie had lived, you know, maybe walk the same sidewalks, look at the same views of the Chattahoochee River, maybe meet some people that had known him. A year later, in May 2009, I created an exhibit called A Break in the Battle. It included 43 of these large banners with their faces, their words, and obviously the tattoos. Also, we had poetry written by a squad leader in Iraq named Brian Turner called Here Bullet, and video interviews of local tattoo artists. One made the comment to me that that he thought the temporary pain that occurs when you're being tattooed almost serves as a mask or a small break from that deeper emotional pain that they are experiencing. Students, business people, and of course soldiers representing the infantry, airborne, and ranger units made it happen. I love seeing people connecting whose paths might not ordinarily cross. Carolyn, a woman in her 80s, said she'd never look at tattoos in the same judgmental way. Art students and soldiers found themselves chatting together, and a teacher brought her elementary school class. There is a power in art as a response to trauma, whether it be words, music, pictures. Something happens in that newly created space, and I trust it. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but they bring out the stories as well. For me, I think the most gratifying parts of this whole project was to be told how much it mattered to the soldiers and their families, and to be trusted with these stories. This was personal. I lost my son, James Andrew Dalton, Jamie, and now you've heard part of mine. Thank you.
You're listening to Echoes of War, an original production of Four on the Floor Theater and the Arcata Playhouse, documenting local veterans, their families, and survivors of war. For more information and to view companion images to this broadcast, please visit our website, echoesofwar.org. That's echoesofwar.org.
Doing the math the other day, 25% of pretty much everyone I knew in the military has killed themselves if they survived the combat. In 10 years I've been home, it's 80 to 90,000 veterans have committed suicide. It's 16 times more deadly to return home from combat than to be deployed to it. So maybe instead of asking the veterans, what can we do? Like, what the f*** is wrong with society? What's wrong with everyone else? We know what's wrong with veterans. It's probably the same type of abandonment I had from the military, is you feel no different than a shovel. You get used for a desired purpose, and okay, we're done digging that hole. We're just going to throw you back in the tool shed and forget about you.
My name is Cody Drury. I served in the Army Infantry, and I exited as an E-1.
I always kind of wanted to be a soldier, since as long as I can remember. I never wanted to be a firefighter or any of that. I always wanted to be a soldier. As I hit my teenage years, in my super gung-ho mentality, I was like, yeah, let's go be infantry. And I dropped out of high school, went to a community college, got my GED, and enlisted before I would have graduated. For me, infantry school was a blast. It was everything I was interested in, with none of the real danger. Lots of ranges, machine guns, rockets, tow missiles, grenade launchers. It was just a whole pile of fun. I've kind of tried explaining the combat stuff to people who don't really have an idea. For me, the combat was primal. It was easy. When it got to that point to where shots were being fired, I simply didn't want to die. My platoon was not nice. No matter what I did, I was always the FNG. I was a scapegoat, the black sheep. It was really demoralizing. That is why I really wanted to quit. I was with a bunch of people that I hated. I just gave up. And so I intentionally failed my physical fitness test. Basically got kicked out as a fat body. Honorable discharge, just unsatisfactory performance. And it was a trip to Kuwait where I basically waited for another flight, which was actually one of the best flights of my life. We had like civilian-looking stewardesses that were giving us cabin instructions. Please point the barrel of your weapon towards the fuselage. If your weapon is too big to lay down in front of you, we can provide you with another seat. I mean, we had guys with sniper rifles and machine guns, and It was just your typical 737. We're all fully armed, and it was just kind of fun. But when I ended up getting picked up in Palm Springs by my mother, we were given free parking. That's why it pissed me off when I see, like, all these big celebrations now for, oh, look, the cooks have returned. Like, that's cool. Like, for me specifically, where I grew up in Riverside County, I was the first one to make it home other than in a body bag. It just kind of set the stage for the next 10 years of no one giving a f-. Couldn't even tell you most of what happened for the first year and a half, 2 years I was home. I was just trying to find the prize at the bottom of the bottle like it was Cracker Jacks. And so I eventually got up to here. Then my mother passed. And so at that point, I was literally out of guidance. What do you do? I come home, I'm a fucking mess. My parents are dead. My sister doesn't talk to me. All my, who used to be my friends, all hate me. All they saw were the problems that came back and, you know, my endless fighting. I basically spent 10 years not doing anything, trying to hide. I've had a few flashbacks. When I was living in McKinleyville, that was the night I died. I was working on my Camaro with a buddy of mine. Apparently, instincts kicked in. I went running down the street screaming. A number of police arrived to try to detain me. Apparently, I was referring to them as terrorists and disarming them as they would draw their guns. Apparently, I was slapping their guns into yards and throwing them away. And luckily, none of them decided to shoot me. Instead, they beat me to death. That was the first step to moderation. It was like, oh, I got beat to death. Maybe I shouldn't drink so much. And I can't speak for all the other veterans and what they've been through and what they're experiencing. But if we never share our struggles, then how can we ever expect society to understand us better? As I've gotten over a lot of my issues, I realize how much kind of nicer it can be when you can finally relax, when you feel good about yourself again. A lot of our people need that, not just veterans, but Americans and people around the world that suffer these indignities. They need the assistance as well. They need the guidance. And basically, we left civilians behind. I think it should also be our responsibility to continue to help America, because that's what we are. I mean, we didn't just join the military, not all of us, for a paycheck. And a lot of us did it because we're patriotic. We love our country, and we want it to become better. The more awareness and the more information we can spread about is just all the better.
I have no idea what I'm doing alive. You know, my life was, it was a mess from 16 years old. I joined the Merchant Marine. All my brothers had been, World War II, they already joined the military, and I was too young. But the Merchant Marine was taking 16-year-olds, so because there was nobody else to sail the ships. They were all military. And the Merchant Marine is civilians. Richard Holstein, H-O-L-S-T-E-I-N, like the black and white cow. And at 16, I was on my first merchant ship on the way to the Philippines with the cargo we had, hundreds of thousands of cases of beer. Beautiful cargo, especially going into a war zone, yeah. But on the way over, they dropped that damn bomb. And a few days later, we pulled into Leyte, where MacArthur had his invasion fleet getting ready to go into Japan itself. You know, probably a million GIs. But when he dropped the bomb, it held it all off. He didn't have to invade. Then I sailed for about 4 or 5 years, I guess. Then the war ended, and the Korean War broke out. All those young kids that were 16 sailing, now we're all ripe for the Korean War. Then I got home, I went right back to sea. I couldn't wait to get back on the ship after this army saluting, yes sir, no sir, and always somebody above you. Every time I got back into San Francisco, I'd call home, let my mother know I was there. God, she never knew where I was going to be, you know, all over the world. About 2 years after I got an army sailing, and she told me, son, it has been 5 consecutive years that you've missed the holidays and your birthday at home. Get off that damn ship. So I quit sailing, I got a job on the beach. I had a lot of girls wanting to get married. Everybody seemed to want to get married, and you know, I was going to sea. I didn't want to mess up like that. So I just kept fooling around. I finally met this girl that I drank a lot. All sailors, seamen do. Finally met this girl that could outdrink me. I get so drunk, she'd drive me home, and she'd go home. You know? That's the one I married. So it turned out okay. We had a boy and a girl. The military was good to me, I guess, you know, because I did get my stripes and ranks and awards and stuff, but you don't think about that. You know, it's just something that happened. Until I got back up here and joined the Veterans of Foreign Wars, I'd forgotten what all that stuff was about.
I met this guy shortly before his wife passed away, sweet woman. My name is Dominic Tarantino. I lost my dad really young. He's the closest thing to
me. He adopted me.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to get rid of the guy since then, you know that? As much as
I love him, and I'll do anything for him. His son didn't care for me when we met because he thought, you know, what's this guy doing? This is my dad. And it was like, I said, you know what? You can think of me as your brother, but I don't want anything but the love that this man has. And we've shared a lot of stories over the years, both his and mine. I just remember some of the shit he told me he went through. You know, it tears at you. It tears in your heart because what he had to go through. And
Joel Beach is at Graham now.
Yeah, I do love him like a dad. I call him dad.
Yeah, but he's snide the way he says it.
Yeah. I want to tell you about something that he related to me one time. And he started telling me about this one night when they were told to hold a hill. And he said, we didn't have enough ammunition. The Chinese, they come in droves. You lost, what, 16 guys that night?
Every night we lost it.
Well, they tried to pull him off the line the next day. A lieutenant came up and wanted to give him a Purple Heart or Bronze Star or something, Medal of Honor. And he denied it. He was injured that night, but he denied it. And he said, no, he said, I'm not a hero. Go home, tell their parents. That had such a profound effect on me, you know, the character he is.
Call me a character.
Yeah, I did. But my service time, I wouldn't take $1 million for what I went through.
Ain't that a bitch?
I was 18 years old when I went in. When I came out, I was an adult. I needed direction, and I got it. I came out, I had seen so much more. I went home. Everything was the same as it was when I left. I wanted more. I landed in Travis and then went home to New York, and my whole family was there. And back then, you had to travel in uniform. I couldn't wait to get out of the uniform. You know, it was good to see my family, but even within my family, there was a bunch of political stuff. I mean, I had a brother who, he's passed away now, but he was prior service to me. He went in about 3 years before I did and got out. I didn't like what he was doing, and if I could have put him in prison, I would have, because of stolen valor. No polite way to say it. He was a liar and a thief. What he did was misrepresentation of veterans, and you have a lot of that out there.
Yeah.
You know, that people, they're wannabes. They want the glory to say they were a veteran, but they never were. You know, for some reason, it gives them some sort of prestige. Well, that's bullshit. I have two sons in the Air Force right now. What they have to do in combat is so much different than what Rick faced. And I was an information technology specialist, so I didn't see any combat other than IBM cards. But my youngest son, he's at Beale Air Force Base. He said, Dad, he said, you know, he said, what we do here, he said, this is one of the largest drone bases in the U.S. He said, but we do strictly surveillance. People scream at us that we're killing babies. We're using drones to kill babies. And he said, that just hurts. He said, because we don't have one armed drone in Beale. For people to not have the full understanding of what the hell's going on, he said, it just tears them apart. I'm sure he has some form of PTSD, but he can't talk about it. With the way politics is now, if he was to openly admit he had PTSD, he would probably lose his clearance. He would probably lose his weapons. He would probably be labeled as a loaded, you know, ready to just, you know, yeah, you're crazy. You shouldn't be in society, or you should be drugged so hard that you can't be in society. I just worry with the guys that are coming home today, they're not getting the attention that they really need, and we shouldn't be doing that. There should be more reaching out.
I came from an old family dating to pre-Revolutionary War times, but I ran away from home in Pennsylvania at the age of 16. Traveling through the Deep South during the Mississippi summer of 1963, but hardly aware of the significance of the civil rights movement that was occurring around me.
John and Josie Brown.
I then enlisted for 3 years in the U.S. Army in 1967, serving in a recon platoon in Vietnam during the 1968 Tet Offensive and infantry companies of the 1st and 9th Infantry Divisions in heavy combat with many casualties. When I was wounded in the Mekong Delta and medevaced to the United States on Christmas Eve of 1968, on my way to witness Nixon's inauguration, I was spat upon in uniform by four people at once, which came as a shock as I had by then turned against the war because of what I had seen in Vietnam. After recovering from my wounds, I was assigned as an orderly working for the nurses, taking care of worst wounded GIs in the huge Walson Army Hospital at Fort Dix, New Jersey, when I met my future wife, Josie, at an anti-war off-base coffee house.
I was a 19-year-old student at Barnard College and the Columbia University Uprising then in 1968, a leader of Students for a Democratic Society in the anti-war movement. SDS split into factions, one of which, including many of my friends, became known as the Weathermen. But another group of us went down to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and opened a GI coffee house. And we started printing and distributing Shakedown, an underground newspaper of anti-war soldiers and radical students' voices. You started writing a column for the paper right away. I also used to come visit you in the hospital where I saw many more horribly wounded young soldiers unable to move from their beds. The hospital made both of us more radical about ending the war.
When we got married in 1969, it was reported in several New York newspapers because of Josie's leadership in SDS at Columbia University, which got the attention of the FBI and military intelligence, who accused me of being a communist in threatening interrogations and tried to get me to disobey a lawful order so they could put me in the stockade. But I got an honorable discharge in 1970 and took my wife Josie to California to start a new life. The FBI were following us around and even accusing me and Josie of terrorist acts in classified documents. At the same time, my wife's former comrades in SDS had gone underground as the Weathermen. Simultaneously, I was told by my English teacher at Cabrillo College in Santa Cruz to stand up with a fellow veteran of the 101st Airborne and confess our war crimes in Vietnam in front of the whole class.
Married me, 20 years old, to a Vietnam combat veteran? What did I really know about war and this new husband of mine? I'd seen the hospital and now had met many other GIs. My father, Anthony Duke, had been a World War II Navy commander at Normandy Beach in Okinawa, and his was a glorious war. But for us, this war was very different. There were nights when John would wake me up by his shouting, sweating, and pounding on the wall. Another time dragging me under a car when he heard a sound like a gunshot. He had flashbacks and got agitated and upset so easily he was having trouble breathing. He was still living in the war zone, but I didn't understand.
Yeah, I did have symptoms of PTSD in California, but I got cured by consulting with an old doctor who was in an iron lung, who said I could get over my breathing trouble maybe by changing my life.
The changing of our life was what I call wilderness therapy, and I guess I needed it too.
We went to Alaska for a few months and then moved into the wilderness of northern British Columbia for another year. We were denied immigration to Canada because the FBI told the Canadian government we were revolutionaries. So we suddenly immigrated to Brazil and traveled 1,000 miles west in an old jeep to the frontier of the Amazonian north of Mato Grosso. We lived on ranches and in a village for more than a year, learning Portuguese and exploring parts of Amazonia, looking for the perfect land to settle on. Meanwhile, we didn't realize the U.S. government had sent cables to Brazil saying we were dangerous revolutionaries, thereby endangering our lives during a military dictatorship. Our son Moses was born in Mato Grosso in 1973 with Down syndrome. We didn't know what it meant for his life or ours, so we suddenly returned to the U.S. to consult American doctors. In the footloose way of youth, we ended up settling in Alaska again for the next 14 years, living in the wilderness, growing and hunting our food, raising 5 children on the Kenai Peninsula and the western side of Kodiak Island. I worked part-time as a logger, longshoreman, pack horse outfitter and guide, and as a commercial fisherman with my own boat. After I survived a major head injury while king crabbing, I wrote my first book, Rice Paddy Grunt. It's a non-fiction narrative of the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement, a eulogy to the people I served with and later protested with. It also helped several men I served with get veterans benefits after the U.S. government said their records had been lost. Writing the book was a catharsis and helped me overcome the war and PTSD, along with living so many years in the solitude of the wilderness with a wife and five growing children. We sold a Kodiak salmon permit and moved south from Alaska in 1988, buying a small cattle ranch in the Mattol Valley of Humboldt County. And that's where we have remained for the past 26 years, raising our five children along with cattle and crops.
In 1997, I started a summer camp, Lost Coast Camp, to share this wilderness therapy with children, many from homes with poverty, drugs, incarceration, hopelessness. Together, you and I, we've found counselors and taken care of 170 kids every summer since then. And it's given us a lot of work and a lot of peace.
The success of my first book led to a request by several military officers and a U.S. congressman that I conduct extensive research among thousands of recently declassified secret U.S. intelligence documents concerning POWs and MIAs in the American National Archives using the Freedom of Information Act. I ended up assisting the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff and the Senate Select Committee on POW-MIA Affairs through Senator Robert Grassley and Senator Bob Smith from 1990 to 1993. I also broke the story on American prisoners of war held in the Soviet Union after World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. At the request of the Senate Select Committee on POW-MIA Affairs, I published a book on this subject entitled Moscow Bound. Since that time, I just remained at work on our ranch in Josie's summer camp, now enjoying five grandchildren and dealing with various health issues with the help of my loving wife of 46 years.
Growing up, although we didn't know the diagnosis then because it hadn't even been created, my dad suffered from PTSD because if we went to wake him up in the middle of the afternoon, if he was taking a nap, we learned to shake him and run because he'd come out swinging. He would talk in his sleep, apparently had nightmares. I think one way that he coped with his experience in the military was by drinking.
Kathy Rose Noble, senior clinical social worker, retired.
This particular day, my mom was very upset because my father had gone to the bar and spent money that she thought should be identified for groceries. And so they got into an argument, and my father took the money out of his pockets and threw it at my mother. And my mother was really not very assertive. And so when they'd get in fights, she would just cry. She never was able to set any boundaries. We always knew when the fight was over at our house because my dad would take my mom to the Dairy Queen for a hot fudge sundae. So this particular day, we had no car, so we borrowed the neighbor's car. My dad was unable to drive because he lost his license. The car was a stick shift, and my mom wasn't used to driving a stick shift. A soldier off the fort, he was driving drunk and hit us broadside, whereupon my mother was killed right in front of my face. Everybody else in the car was injured, so they went by ambulance. The police officer took me to the hospital because I was not injured. And I was hysterical. I mean, I could see my mother and I knew she was dead, and it was just horrific. And so I was hysterical, and the police officer started screaming at me to shut up. So when we got to the hospital, I'm the only one in the waiting room, and a nurse comes out and tells me, "Your mom's dead." And the Joneses came, and they took me home with them. At least I got to go home with somebody that I knew. that was a pivotal point in our family life because my dad suffered from a tremendous amount of shame and guilt. Plus, I don't think he ever stopped loving my mother. Eventually, my dad, his whole life revolved around drinking, and he died at 55, secondary to his alcoholism. Now, meanwhile, he had multiple hospitalizations in the VA hospital. You know, the doctors flat out told us, if your dad does not stop drinking, he's going to die. But he was never able to quit drinking, and I think in large part because he never forgave himself for what happened. And in that time period, there were no real good treatments for PTSD, so the focus of his counseling was on his drinking, which was important, but wasn't the whole story for my dad. So eventually, in my mid-30s, I went back to school, deciding that I would become a social worker, and found it very rewarding and actually found my experience of watching somebody die, of growing up in an alcoholic family, of being exposed to physical abuse, domestic violence. At one point, we were homeless. So all these experiences kind of helped me be able to relate to people. And so I was trained in a modality called cognitive processing therapy, which is an evidence-based treatment strategy for PTSD. And I met many, many people like my dad and many Vietnam veterans who had similar issues. And those young people started coming back, sounding very much like the Vietnam veterans, like the World War II veterans, like the Korean War veterans, and the Coast Guard veterans who actually, now that they have to do drug interdictions, have some really horrific stories to tell about their service. I treated some officers who carry an extreme amount of guilt for people that died under their command, who have some horrible kind of recollections of what they've done, and consequently suffering from PTSD. So mainly I saw people with PTSD, with depression, with anxiety, and with alcohol and drug dependence. Maybe 5% or less of our patients were chronically and persistently mentally ill, primarily suffering from schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. So it was very heartwarming to be able to contribute in some way to the veteran population. So I'm really pleased by ending my career there.
I'm a refugee from Nazi Germany. My name is Ursula Osborne. I was born in Hamburg in 1927 to a Jewish family whose ancestors had roots in northern Germany going back for many generations. My parents did not practice the Jewish religion and had become culturally assimilated. After Hitler came to power in 1933, we were no longer welcome. Even as a young child, I could feel the ostracism against Jews. The private elementary school that I attended was run by a kind Jewish lady, and we would sing in the half basement in small groups of maybe 15 boys and girls. A particular song, Die Gedanken sind frei, which means thoughts are free, comes to mind. The Nazis had banned this song, and while we were singing in this basement with the window to the street, I felt scared, and I do not think the teacher knew that I was scared. Whether other children were also scared, I do not know. Die Gedanken sind frei, wer kann sie erraten? Sie fliegen vorbei wie nächtliche Schatten. Kein Mensch kann sie wissen, kein Jäger erschießen mit Pulver und Blei. Die Gedanken sind frei. Ich denke, was ich will und was mich beglücket. Doch alles in der Still und wie es sich schickt. Rocket. Mein Wunsch und Begehren kann niemand verwehren. Es bleibe dabei, die Gedanken sind frei. When synagogues were destroyed throughout Germany during Kristallnacht, which means Crystal Night in English, in November 1938, new laws were enforced. To ensure good education, our parents chose to send us to England. With my younger siblings, Martin and Ruth, we were taken to a railroad station to join a Kinder transport. Each child was allowed one suitcase. I was asked to watch out for my siblings. World War II started, and our parents could not leave Germany until much later. The school we attended in England had to be evacuated from near London to the Midlands for more safety. Nonetheless, awareness of bombing became part of our consciousness at school in Shropshire and while visiting Liverpool and London on vacations. We were aware of preparedness in air raid shelters and of wearing gas masks. That was scary, because direct letters to and from our parents were not possible. We sent our letters to friends in Denmark. They forwarded them, and after Denmark was overrun by Germany, an uncle in Switzerland took over sending our letters from and to our parents. Censors left identifying notations on these letters. In 1944, Ruth and I crossed the Atlantic Ocean to USA for protection against U-boats. The large passenger liner traveled in a convoy. Very few other passengers came along from east to west, while in the opposite direction, thousands of troops were taken in preparation for the Normandy landing. Ruth and I took a train to Los Angeles, where our parents had settled in 1941. After over 5 years, we were happily reunited with them, although the cloud of mourning due to the death of Martin, who had died in England, continued to hang over the family. I went to university, got married, got my United States citizenship, found employment, lived in various states, and after I joined Unitarian Universalism, I was delighted to find us singing Die Gedanken sind frei. It is printed as hymn 291 and Singing the Living Tradition.
Echoes of War is an original production from Four on the Floor Theater and the Arcata Playhouse and is partially funded by the California Humanities Community Stories Project. Echoes of War was produced by Allie Friedland, Jacqueline Dandenau, Zuzka Sabata, and me, Tammy Ray Scott. Thanks to audio engineer Russ Cole and post-production engineer Tim Gray. Special thanks to all the Echoes of War participants for their hard work and courage in sharing their stories. For more information and to view companion images to this broadcast, please visit our website at echoesofwar.org.